I was doing the things that you're supposed to do to have a good life. I had a great family. I was staying in touch with them. I was raising this cute little kid. I had a great job. I was intellectually challenged. I had a good marriage and I had great nutrition and I worked out, but I didn't really have a sense of community. I think a lot of what I've done over the last 15 to 10 years comes out of this idea that you want to find a way to give back, not in the like charitable thing, but in the building of community and the connection with other people to do things together.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Heather Redman. She's the co-founder and managing partner at Flying Fish Ventures. They're a Seattle-based early-stage venture firm that's investing in AI and machine learning. She also has a very unique cross-domain perspective from about a dozen different boards, nonprofits, business, politics, education, the whole range. And we talked about the traits she sees in best founders, her take on building community, and why diversity, equity, and inclusion is important to her. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Heather Redman. Hey, Heather, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Adam.
I've been following you for a long time, so I've been really excited about this conversation. And I wanted to start by asking you about ice cream, because I saw you tweeting about ice cream recently. So I wanted to see if are you serious about ice cream? Are you a big ice cream person?
That's interesting to say. I'm a big gelato person. And really, that's not because gelato is better than ice cream. It's because I am also a person who is fairly calorie aware. And so if I'm going to eat something every night, like I have been with the gelato that I've been eating, it's got to fall within some reasonable parameters. And ice cream can get you up into the 1,000-calorie bracket very quickly. But I will say that one of my favorite companies, which happens to be Pacific Northwest Company, is Salt and Straw. And I'm proud to say that their founder and CEO is an investor in Flying Fish. So there's definitely a sisterhood going on there. But one of the most brilliant things that she ever said to me was that they view ice cream as a platform, which, of course, to a tech person, you're like, whoa, you're speaking my language, but yet I don't understand what you're saying at all. And what she meant by that, which I thought was so brilliant, is that what they want to do is partner with other food people who are really into a couple of ingredients. And ideally, those ingredients are place specific and seasonal. And so they view that sort of like the basics of ice cream, which are what, like cream and sugar and eggs? I don't really know. But the basics of ice cream is being this ideal platform to then transmit any really great flavor and sort of food item that you could think of, and to really communicate like a sense of place or a sense of season. So that's why they do crazy things like bone marrow ice cream, and why when they, you know, open a new location, they're always all about talking to everybody that's local to find out, well, what are the flavors that are really about Santa Barbara, or really about Miami, or wherever it is that they're located. So I guess I'm a follower of ice cream entrepreneurs, in addition to being a huge consumer of gelato.
So I got to ask, have you ever invested or considered investing in a gelato or ice cream company?
No, although I think that would be a good investment. It's like pizza. It's timeless and generationalless. I have made one restaurant investment in my life, and I went into it very eyes open that those can be just sort of the worst investments you can make, but they have tremendous social and network benefits. And when I made that investment with another woman entrepreneur, actually, I was fully expecting to lose my money. And in fact, that did happen. But that was enough. I got the bang for the buck out of that particular investment in terms of relationships and knowledge. And I probably will never do another food-based investment again, just because I think anything that's fun and sexy is likely to lose you money.
Is that a principle you have to avoid the fun and sexy things? Or yeah, that's interesting. I look at some of your companies in your portfolio and think they seem fun and sexy, but maybe that's just because I'm so deep into this tech world. But has that principle guided the way you do business?
They're as fun and sexy as you can be and still be a tech company, probably. Yeah, no, we do like, you know, our pizza making robots. I would say you can't get much more fun and sexy than pizza making robots. But by and large, I think the things that just really appeal to people, whether it's, hey, let's invest in a restaurant, or hey, let's invest in a movie, or let's invest in a winery. Those are all legendary for being great ways to take a large fortune and turn it into a small fortune. So looking at things that are just necessary and make people or businesses more productive, that to me, while not nearly as glamorous, is definitely a better way to make money for yourself or for, in our case, our investors.
Can you walk me through how you do that assessment? Like when an entrepreneur comes to you, how do you start to think about, is this necessary? Is this essential? What's the sort of framework or the mental models that you go through when you're starting to look at something, an opportunity?
Yeah, I do like the mental model that I think a lot of people use, which is, what are you hiring this product or this service to do? And what are you firing in exchange for this service or product? I think that is a good way to think about things. Things are happening so fast now, though, that thinking about something that's replacing something else is not always the right way to think. There are whole new categories being pioneered every day. But basically, because we're seed stage investors, we're really looking at things not so much based on spreadsheet, looking at a sort of margin or revenue even. I wish there were more revenue earlier, but there isn't often. So we're really looking at, what's the market? Is this the right team to address that market? What is the sort of the technical depth of the team? We don't typically, and partly because of our AI ML focus, we don't typically invest in things that are business model heavy, but technology light. So you think of a company like a Rover, that's really a business model innovation. And of course, it requires a lot of tech to make it work, but it's really about a business model innovation. And so we would be less likely to do that kind of investment and more likely to do an investment that was more around a deeper sort of technical, not moat, because it's awfully hard to come up with a moat, but some, you know, tech that's not off the shelf and that really needs some pretty deeply technical founders in order to crack the nut of the tech. And then the standard conversation that everybody has about team, which is they're either domain expertise or they're deep commitment to understanding what the customer in the domain that they're addressing really is all about, and just having that real customer-centric focus, and then the grit and the raw ambition to stick it out, because we all know how hard it is to do anything from scratch. You've built this from scratch, and I'm sure you've built other things from scratch, and I've built with my partners this venture capital firm from scratch. So we know the shoes that these founders walk in. And they're not only really uncomfortable and rickety shoes, but they got to grow a lot, because they have to start out small. And then if they're going to be truly successful, they've got to really scale, which at a venture firm, luckily, you don't have to do. You're really going to remain a little cottage boutique-y business for your entire life if you do it right. And that ability to not only do all that really small, hard startup stuff, and to face failure every day, but then to also be able to maturely scale is a very rare set of attributes. So finding that in the team is certainly the number one thing. And then the market is got to be there. It can't be like we're building booties for left-footed one-eyed chihuahuas or something. It needs to be a big market.
Yeah. How do you do that assessment of finding those founders that have the rare combination of traits and that you think can grow a lot? What are some of the clues that you look for or patterns that you see when you meet founders and talk to them that kind of tell you that, oh, I think they have that unique ability?
It's not like we're geniuses in this, and I don't think anybody is, but one big sort of leading indicator, I think, is either someone who in fact is an immigrant or has an immigrant's life experience or mindset. So we look for people who've had to figure out how to fit in and how to persevere and achieve in a bunch of different environments. And that can certainly be somebody who has, you know, moved to the United States from another part of the world, but it can also show up in a person who's been overlooked or who's had an intellectual difference in their lives that has made it hard for them to fit in, and they've had to figure out how to be successful in somebody else's world. And I think that's a very helpful set of attributes for a founder, but it's a fine line. We often talk about just crazy enough and not too crazy. And I think we all watch Elon Musk walk that line every day. There is a real fine line sometimes between all of the skills and personality attributes that it takes to build something really big and ambitious, and things that can be your undoing. And then you couple that with some of the innovations that we've seen in corporate structure and some of the capital markets characteristics that we have right now. And things can go not only bad for the founder and the investors and the employees, but bad for society too. We're looking for a mixture of ambition and ethics and teamwork and empathy and just someone. It's not even reasonable to ask one person to be all of these things, but it does seem to me that it shows up in immigrants more often than in any other group of people, and that immigrant sensibility can be something that you acquire through some other mechanism besides being an actual for real immigrant.
As you're saying all those things, it definitely makes me think that is a hard exercise in terms of somebody like me, analytical. I want to put everything into a spreadsheet, and it definitely seems very nuanced and a little bit elusive in how you would weight all those factors.
Yes, it's interesting. We look sometimes at other VCs, and we don't disparage anybody's method, but we see other VCs be a lot more spreadsheet focused than we are, and not just as a methodology, but also as a screening mechanism of where are these people in terms of, let me see the market proven out, let me see the customer traction proven out, like those sorts of proof points that can still be very conjectural at the early stage. You may have a great financial model built out, but it might not be accurate. We think that the VC job, particularly at the early stage and maybe later too, I'm not sure because that's not where we're investing. So I want to be humble about what I know about that later stage. But for the early stage, there's a lot of psychology, and not just psychology around making the choice of investment, but psychology around being chosen to be the investor. And then psychology around working with that entrepreneur and their team as you together, because once you've written the check, it's like your problem as much as their problem if there's a failure, if not more so, right? And so you want to help as much as you can. And that helping can't be the helping of, hey, I need to see your quarterly results. That helping has to be what is going on and what are the ways in which I can either help you see the things you need to see but aren't, or how can I help you get out of bed the next day and carry on? Because both of those things can be the issue du jour in an early stage company.
You mentioned earlier the jobs to be done framework, Clayton Christensen, and what am I hiring this product to do? Mm-hmm. It sounds like you have a way of thinking about that for the thing you're offering as a VC. Do you have an answer to like what your founders and portfolio companies are hiring you to do?
Yeah, we do. And it does vary to some degree, but I think some of the things that differentiate us from the vast kind of, if you were to generalize VCs, and again, I hate to do that because I don't think it's fair, but we fall on the side of being more operator-ish and more technologist ish than I think the median VC. My two partners, Jeff and Frank, are very deep technically and really want to sit down with what we see mostly, which are technical founders, and kind of geek out on the tech. And that, rightly or wrongly, that often helps us win deals, because a lot of other folks who are in VC, they characterize as the quote unquote money guys. And so they want the money guys, because obviously you want the check and you want the expertise that comes with somebody who understands how is capital raised, what's going to happen after you get through your seed, where are you going to go next, and how do you want to think about how you structure that, and what's a good exit look like, and what are some of the pitfalls, and all of that, sort of the craft of VC land. But they are at heart, mostly, particularly in our neck of the woods, technical founders. And so having an investor on the other side of the table that really understands what they're trying to do with the product, what are the technical challenges they have to overcome, who are the people they need on their team in order to overcome those technical challenges, that is really comforting and welcome amongst technical founders. And then the other thing that we see very often is a desire for help with first customers. And so one of the things that we bring to the table, partly through me and through some of our other venture partners and managing directors, especially Adrian Brown, is a real broad network in terms of other industries that we know people in, and a real network of C-suite folks across a whole range of industries. So we're often able to make those first customer introductions when someone is saying, hey, I want to talk to the pulp and paper industry. There are a lot of VCs that may not have any relationships in the pulp and paper industry, but we do. And that's just something that's come out of our careers and also just out of principally my crazy idea that I should try to know everybody and understand everybody's pain points in business, which is my passion. And then the last thing I would say that comes up a lot is our diverse team and our sort of commitment to diversity, which is still a work in progress and nothing that I want to hold up as the example everybody should follow. But I think we've done more and thought more and shown more in terms of our own team composition and our own investor makeup, and even in the investments that we've made and the diversity of our founders. We've done a lot, especially for our stage and our size, to really think through DEI. And they see it when people come to pitch us. They're like, wow, this looks like a different group of people than what I often see when I'm pitching to VCs, and I appreciate it. So particularly diverse teams, or teams that maybe aren't diverse but wish they were and want to build a diverse company because they think that's how you win, they often gravitate toward us because they see that we're struggling with the same issues, and we have the same belief that you win by building diversity in at the base of what you're doing, whatever it is.
I love that. And there's a lot I want to follow up on there. There's so much good stuff there. The first thing I have to ask you about in that is, you mentioned your passion for knowing everybody. Where did that come from? And can you tell me more specifically what that looks like and what that kind of shows up in and how you operate?
Yeah, I guess I'm still trying to figure out life, and definitely still on a big journey there. But we actually just talked to a founder as I was driving up to the San Juans today. My two partners and I talked to a founder who's an ex-Amazonian. She's building something incredible that has to do with health. And we were talking and we were exchanging what are the sort of foundations that she's learned about so far around health. And one of the things she mentioned was community. And I just completely resonated with me, because that was my aha moment probably about 15 years ago now, when I recognized that I was doing the things that you're supposed to do to have a good life. I had a great family. I was staying in touch with them. I was raising this cute little kid, and I had a great job. I was intellectually challenged. I had a good marriage. And I had great nutrition and I worked out, but I didn't really have a sense of community. And I was raised by hippies and in communes and had a really tumultuous, not a bad childhood, but a super tumultuous childhood of moving around a lot. And I said to my husband, who's a quasi Seattle native, he moved to Seattle when he was 6 months old. I said to him, I want to have a commitment ceremony with Seattle and with kind of the people that I feel like are my tribe that are in Seattle and are around the world. And I want to be more interested in other people that are not just part of my kind of familial unit and not just part of my little friend group. And out of that, I think a lot of what I've done over the last 15 to 10 years comes out of this idea that you want to find a way to give back, not in the like charitable thing, but in the building of community and the connection with other people to do things together. And even though I had that really disconnected childhood, it always felt like you could just pick up stakes and move to another country or move here, just like that nomadic feeling. I've tried to become as rooted as I can in this particular geography that we're in now, but also in kind of the larger cause of how do we, you know, make the world through technology and through investing a better place and include more people in it, which I think is job one for making it a better place. And the knowing a lot of people, even though I'm inherently introverted, the knowing a lot of people is just come to be for me this constant reinforcement that the every time I meet a new person and I find out something about them and I learn from them, I just feel like, wow, that just made my day so much better. And that's just in the meeting them and the learning about them. And then when I get to loop back with them and actually do something for them out of other people that I've met, connect them with someone who's meaningful to them, or have them help one of our portfolio companies or somebody else who's working on some important cause, I just feel like I've done something for the day, and there's meaning that's generated out of that. And venture is a great place for people who are that kind of person. And I've constructed myself into that sort of person. I don't think I was born that way or inherently that way, but it's a great way to feel useful and to be constantly stimulated by new people and their great ideas and their great thoughts around what they're doing and why. And so it's a lot of work, and the amount of half hour Zoom calls on my calendar right now, or in the past half hour coffees on my calendar, is just insane, but it's so rewarding that I can't stop doing it.
So 15 years ago, you had this aha, and you had this kind of commitment to the community. In that journey, what's changed about your view on community or been surprising about that process as you've been so intentional toward that?
I think one of the things that's been really disappointing for me, and this is, I'm a lifelong Democrat, I'd say liberal to progressive in my thinking on just about every issue, it's much harder than I thought to bridge the gap between my values and the, you know, people that I would think I would be naturally allied with politically and what I believe I do with a lot of righteousness and goodness on the business side. The disconnect between business and democratic politics, particularly as they show up on the West Coast, has been really disappointing, because I'd like my life to be more integrated. And instead, I feel like I'm constantly the person in the political discussions that is saying, but business, it can be good, and it is often very good, and we shouldn't be making these distinctions between small business and big business. We should be talking about good business and bad business. And that's probably been the most disturbing thing in terms of how do I integrate everything I do in the Pacific Northwest, is that the left, the leftmost part of the left Democratic Party, or I shouldn't even say Democratic Party, because I shouldn't attribute a lot of these folks to the Democratic Party. They're leftists of their own stripe. They just don't want to have any part of business. And it's very hard to understand how we provide jobs for people if we don't have business. And so that's probably the thing I'm most disturbed about right now in terms of how I think about how we move our community forward. We have to break down some of those barriers and thereby harness all of society's resources toward solving the problems that we have to solve. But if we don't have good relationships between the various centers of power in a society, and especially in a small society like Seattle or the Pacific Northwest, if we don't have alignment between all those various power structures and the sort of shared set of values and trust and commitment to work together, then we won't be able to solve those problems. And that's tragic. On the plus side, since making that sort of grandiose statement of I'm going to take responsibility for this community and I'm going to get super involved, it's amazing how easy it is to find connections and to find things to work on with other people and to just get deeply enmeshed in a society and culture that is just dying for people that care and want to work on stuff and want to connect others. So I would definitely encourage people who you know, are feeling like they're missing something, to believe that they can get super, super connected and be really enriched and valuable to their community by doing that.
Yeah, one of the questions I was going to ask you, which is maybe related, is just how do you participate in so many things? Because I was printing out your bio, and I think just to get the list of board seats in between nonprofits and committees and education, it's like I think I killed a few trees in the process, and I decided to go digital instead. So how are you able to think about balancing all that? And you mentioned you're booked with a lot of coffees and now Zooms. But yeah, how does that balance into this the busy day-to-day of actually making money for your LPs?
Yeah. No, it's a juggling act for sure. I don't have any hobbies, and my kids are all out of the nest now. So that helps, other than the colorizing my closet that we talked about that I haven't gotten to yet. But there's really nothing. I live in a condo. There's really nothing that I have to do other than this stuff that I love doing, which is mostly sort of people related and intellectual and conceptual. So I have a lot more time than other people have just because I don't do all those other things. But I also believe, and this may be complete fantasy on my part, but I believe that if you are picky, choosy about the things that you do, and so I don't say yes to everything, but I believe that if you're strategic and thinking about the people that you spend time with and the things that you do, that weirdly you can break the time space physics of things, and that you can add new things to your plate. And that as you add those new things, it actually makes all of the existing things that are already there easier. And I believe in this sort of power of synergy and the Venn diagram of, if you get these circles to overlap in the right way, then suddenly you've achieved this perfect balance of things that they all mutually aid one another. And I'm sounding like I've got some sort of Japanese concept of corporate interlocking relationships or something. You end up with this really nice portfolio that is beneficial to each other in a way that I may not show up for every meeting. And that's definitely more and more the case as I get further along with the venture fund. But if the CEO or executive director or whomever of that organization need something, I'm probably going to be one of the people most likely to be able to provide it because of all that other stuff that I've got circling around. And so sometimes I will agree to do things, but I'll agree saying, you're not going to get a lot of my time, even though I am so fascinated by what you're doing. And if I had the time, I would be at every single meeting and probably be annoying. But what I will commit to do is that when you need something and I have the power to do it, I'll do it. And that's for a smart CEO, they're okay with that because they want also a bunch of tools in their tool set, and you're just a particular kind of tool to them. And that's fine.
That's such a powerful idea. It sounds like an extreme of the Pareto 80-20, or what Charlie Munger talks about with everything being interrelated, and the Lollapalooza effect, right? When all these sort of factors stack up in the same direction, you can get some pretty extreme benefits. And I can see that with all the things you do. I was not picking it out at first, but as you're describing, I'm thinking, yeah, I can see common threads across all the nonprofits as well as the business stuff that you're engaging in.
Yeah. And sometimes it's the uncommonness. So I love, back to the Venn diagram concept, I love being the only person in the overlap of two disparate circles, because then I've become this really pivotal, important piece between two important unrelated sectors. And I don't believe anything is ever unrelated. So that's going to be handy to both circles to have me there, as long as I'm credible to both circles.
I love that. So it exposes these cases where you're providing something that otherwise wouldn't be possible by virtue of the interrelatedness between these seemingly disconnected things.
With the pace of change that we're going through right now, things just don't stay apart. Everything's on a collision course all the time. So it's, even if something is like way off there in space and this other thing's over here, eventually they're going to rub up against each other in a way that could be super productive or could be really unproductive if there isn't a translator there. And if I can play that role once in a while, that's amazing.
You talked earlier about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that being a differentiator of Flying Fish Partners and a focus of yours. How does that sort of tie back to this principle or this focus that you have around community?
Yeah, that's an interesting combination. One of the things when you are thinking about how to be interested and interesting, which is one of the principal ways to keep your life moving in a positive direction, is bringing new people who are not like you into your life. And so from just a sort of a selfish kind of who do I want to be every morning and who do I want to spend time with every day, the breaking down of the flocking of birds of a feather together and instead continually bringing in new elements into your life, that's just so enriching and so valuable. But from a business perspective, that I think DEI is it's both a, okay, we're going to be a better business because we are a diverse team. And so we can see things from a lot of different angles and we'll make better decisions and we'll understand the world in a more complete way. So the bigger market will be available to us because we can see it all as opposed to just being able to see one narrow niche. And the stories around that are legendary. But also you can look at it from the flip side. So that's the sword. So we're going to go out and rule the world because we've got this really powerful sword that's built, you know, with this really diverse team. But the shield concept, I think, also comes into play. And we see this a lot in AI, actually, which is that we want to future-proof our companies and ourselves from the reckoning that is coming, right? An AI that is not built by diverse teams, and really any company that's not built by a diverse team, is ultimately going to be at a much higher risk of a fatal flaw or complete failure. Because you've just built this thing that's really fragile and spindly and has all these blind spots. And so it's when we had a company that was doing a bunch of stuff in facial recognition. And the first thing I said is, let's really talk to the founders. This is before we made the investment, about how they're thinking about this. And are they thinking about it as like, how can we be sure facial recognition is a force for good? Or how are they thinking of, let's go do a bunch of stuff and hope nobody notices what we're doing, which is your typical like startup thing of, we're just trying to stay under the radar until we figure out whether this is a business. And instead we were like, no, let's get really robust here and talk about where this could go and plan for success and plan for the future, future-proof ourselves. And they were so open to that, but it was a journey for them because they hadn't really thought about it that way. Because the more common approach is just, I'm going to try to stay below the radar. So instead, if you think of, what if we're in the radar from day one and we're building a company in the spotlight, and who would we want to have around the table in that case? And so we started sourcing those people. They ended up not needing facial recognition at all, and it ended up being a moot point. But that exercise was really good in helping the founders understand who we are and what we could bring to the table, and also our ethical approach to things, but also us helping understand how they think and how they developed their ideas and how open they were to hearing other people's as well. So that was just an example of how you've got to be future-proofing all the time, but it's not viewed as like, how do we avoid X, Y, or Z bad thing? It's also, how do we build the strongest and biggest company possible?
Let's wrap up with the supersonic six. Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
I am really into mushroom coffee these days, but also into sleep. So I am pretty much down to 2 cups a day.
Number two, what's one Seattle company that you're following or studying right now outside of your portfolio?
Oh, interesting. I like this company, Sanctuary. They're building these little studios that are, it sounds super indulgent, and it is, but it's also, I think, really good from a mental health perspective. But basically, you book a room and that room is yours, and it has a full, one wall is a screen, and you can do a guided meditation or a yoga class. And there's your own private sort of shower room to the side, and you can pick the temperature in advance and what kind of tea you want. And so it's like this sort of mini retreat environment. And when I first heard about it, I was like, that sounds really cool, but I don't think I'd ever use it. And then right pre-pandemic, I got to use it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I want to use this all the time. And then of course, pandemic happened and I haven't been using it. But I think that's a smart idea that's not AI at all. And so not an investment for us, but a pretty interesting idea.
Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
There's a lot of folks that I really like. I am looking forward to getting to know some of the new and old mayoral candidates. I think those are people that we all should be following right now.
Number four, what's one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
We need more capital. And we need more of an attitude amongst all of us of putting more capital back into the ecosystem. We haven't quite developed, and for lots of good reasons, but we haven't quite developed that cycle, that virtuous cycle that the Valley has, where you make some money in a startup, you put some money back into the startup ecosystem. And that can be weird down the Valley of lots of FOMO and buzzy this and that. But we could do it Northwest style, and I think do a better job of it. But many people, after they make their whatever their little nut is in startup land or big company land, but in tech in general, they never invest back in the startup ecosystem. And I think that's a missed opportunity for them and for their sort of lives and pocketbooks, but also a real liability for the ecosystem.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Oh, gosh. I think I was not brave enough and probably still am not brave enough. And if I could tell my younger self to be braver, that would be something I would do.
And last question, number six, what can this community do to help you? Is there any call to action that you have, anything you want people to go pay attention to or check out after listening?
Yeah, I'd say everyone should think about this concept of being committed to their community and really choose a community. And that can be geographic or that can be otherwise, but just recognize that you are a big fish in whatever pond that is. I don't care how big it is. You are a big fish in that pond if you start, you know, moving your fins around a little bit. And that's not to say you're super important, but just that you can have a huge impact. And we need, particularly in Seattle, to all do more to have a bigger impact, because we do have a ton of issues that we need to address. And unfortunately, a lot of us are just feeling helpless and passive about those issues right now. And we need to get over that and recognize that we all have a lot of agency.
Thank you for that closing message. And thanks so much for your time today. This has been great. I've learned a lot from talking with you and really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Adam. I really enjoyed speaking with you. You're a great interviewer, and I appreciate you're asking me to do this. It's an honor.
Yeah, absolutely. Next time, hopefully it'll be over a scoop at Salt and Straw. Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.